Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a rather stormy March 19th, 2012 installment of the Heretics Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Yeager. I will be here the next 2 hours talking to you mainly about the Gliwice incident, which certain elements among us continue to label a false flag operation by the Nazis that started World War II. Wow, to think that something so small could start the most destructive war in the history of the world, it really boggles the mind. What is more strange is why so many supposed truth seekers and truth tellers continue to pretend to believe this in the face of so little evidence. That's what I will be exploring tonight, as much as the what really happened part of it. If you want to read some good background for the German-Polish War, which is what it was, I recommend the article The Fateful Decisions, Irreversible Consequences, which is easily found on my website, carolynyeager.com. It's on the top right side of the page under my articles, and then click on the little plus sign next to Ein anderer Hitler for the drop-down menu of all the articles in that series. This is about the importance placed by the Germans on their city of Danzig and a corridor or right-of-way through Poland to East Prussia, which had been cut off from the rest of Germany by the Versailles Treaty in 1919. Be sure to read the additional commentary article, Hitler's Final Offer to Poland's Joseph Beck. It details the last-minute diplomatic efforts made by the Hitler government to get a meeting with the Poles before it came to war. In these diplomatic messages, the British were nothing short of devious. Truthfully, when understood in its full context, at this time, August 1939, all parties involved wanted war, except the Germans. So, we'll get to tonight's subject of the Gliwice incident right after I do another reading from Jörg Friedrich's The Fire, The Bombing of Germany, 1940-1945. Tonight's portion begins on page 129, actually, right where I ended 2 weeks ago. This part describes the beginning of the end on the Western Front and some of the pointless slaughter that went on to provide for the safety of the Allied soldiers in their advance at the expense of the lives of the civilian population in the Ruhr Valley. That meaning the carpet bombing of cities and towns most of us have never heard of. I begin here. In March 1945, every German man was declared a soldier. As members of this militia called the, did I tell you the number? Yeah, 129 for those who are following along. All right. As members of this militia called the Volkssturm, they wore odd assortments of uniforms, but at least they sewed their own caps in the patterns of the Wehrmacht, which identified them as combatants. Members of the Volkssturm were not partisans. It was questionable whether they fought as snipers of their own accord or on orders of the Gauleiter, the nearest Waffen-SS leader, or an officer. Things were just as vague regarding the civilian population. Tarrying in small cities and towns were the elderly, young women with children, foreign or forced laborers, evacuees, and soldiers passing through. Often they themselves did not know whether they had gone underground or were seeking to join a front. This muddled ensemble of people were both the resident population and those on the road fleeing the front, the bombs, and the diehard Nazis down to the last Hitler youth. They all were the, quote, will to resist, unquote, in the sights of the mightiest bomb tonnage of all time. Meaning they all these people, all these Germans were seen as resistors by the Allies who were trying to break in And so they didn't distinguish between between them, and also their whole intention was to destroy the will to resist. So this is how they were pictured. In early February, the Allied forces set off for the Rhine. In the north, the 1st Canadian Army, which belonged to Montgomery's group, made it to the lower reaches of the Gauche Xanten. I still didn't find out how to pronounce Xanten, sorry, X-A-N-T-E-N, and Vesel Line. This operation, codenamed Veritable, led the regiment of the 5th Canadian Infantry Brigade to Frederick the Great's summer residence, Moyland Castle. The Wehrmacht had used the towers as an advance command post and the dungeons as ideal protection from shelling. Families from the neighboring farms and villages also spent time in these cellars to escape the weeks of carpet bombing that leveled the Canadians' route. The Regiment de Maisonneuve washed themselves and shaved for the first time in a week, and they played with the top hats they found in the wardrobes. They threw furniture and pictures out the windows for a bonfire in the castle courtyard. It was still cold, and the Canadians made a pot roast. For many, it would be their last meal. Good. You know, it makes me mad that they do this kind of destructive kind of thing just for the fun of it, throwing all that furniture of Frederick the Great and Moyland Castle out the windows, building bonfires and so on. I guess this was some of the Canadians or in a French regiment. Anyway, I don't have much sympathy. So for many, it was going to be their last meal. Experts in forest combat were waiting in Moyland Forest. On February 9th, Simpson and Hodges finally took the Roer Dams, that's R-O-E-R again, which had been flooded by the Germans, thus forcing the U.S. 1st and 9th Armies to wait 2 weeks for the water to recede so they could cross the Roer. Then the war that had been at a standstill for so long was transformed into brilliant movement art. The two armies swept down the western bank of the Rhine. On March 5th, 7th Corps captured Cologne on the eastern bank. Now we're in 45, you know, March 1945, right at the end, while Simpson was looking for a bridge that the Germans had failed to blow up. Though unable to find it, he did find a good ford near Erdogan, north of Krefeld. The eastern bank was weakly fortified, and he presumed his men could operate well in the hinterlands. Simpson's group was attached to Montgomery, who denied Simpson the triumph, since he himself was preparing a grandiose crossing of the river near Wesel. He had already informed the world media about his Operation Plunder. Simpson had to wait 2 weeks before he was included in the spectacle, because the advance of the Canadians ran into difficulties, and the Germans were well entrenched in Wesel. The most capable Allied commander, George Patton, made it across the river in most elegant style. Within 3 days, he had purged the Eifel region and advanced 40 miles with the spearhead of the 4th Armored Division to the western bank of the Rhine. He then followed the river southward towards Speyer and Worms, where he encountered 100,000 adversaries who had been ordered by Hitler to hold the strip along the Rhine's west bank down to the last man, rather than fortifying the east bank as they would have preferred. Patton arrived at two secluded little vineyard towns, Nierstein and Oppenheim, 20 miles from Frankfurt. His engineers built two pontoon bridges in no time, and the troops crossed in silence. "Don't tell anyone," Patton reported to Bradley at the top, "but I'm across. There are so few Krauts around here, they don't know it yet." This was very different from the final judgment that Montgomery held for the world at Wesel. The whole trek there had been a debacle of the sort of the previous autumn. Gauche, probably Gauche, an idle on the Niers, it's a little town, was a farmer's marketplace and railroad junction with a population of 10,000. The Germans had dug out tank trenches there and laid belts of concrete, barbed wire, and mines. The town was a fortification, but Bomber Command had not razed it to the ground, instead destroying only a few church towers and factory smokestacks. The Scottish Highlanders were fired upon from windows, house-to-house combat, from roofs to basements, through courtyards and hiding places in walls, raged in the town. It was a miniature Aachen. The forest corridor, the two wooded mountain crests along the Gogh-Zanten railroad line, became a death trap for the Canadian 2nd and 3rd Infantry Divisions. Snipers hid in the treetops, tanks sank in the mud, and mortars, grenades, and mines claimed their blood tolls. It was the first week of March, and Hürtgen Forest had returned. That was a place I talked about a few weeks ago. That was such a terrible battle, a terrible time for the Allies. A wrath was gathering among the overtired and filthy soldiers heading toward Zanten and the Rhine. Wrath. They experienced the same thing inside the land of the enemy as they had at its border, but did not want to believe their inevitable fate, prolonging the process of dying infinitely. All the disaster in the world had been wished upon them, and in Wesel, that wish was to come true. Now, this is a little section here that I read at the very end last week. Moving ahead, now it's in the middle of what I'm reading now. But it's where, I'll just go through it real fast. Zanten and Wesel face each other, where the Rhine takes a bend at the mouth of the Lippe. The latter was a trade center and had been shipping goods by river from the Munster region since the Middle Ages. I wonder if you can hear that thunder, ladies and gentlemen. It's pouring down rain outside. The former was a Roman veterans encampment and later became the site of the sojourn of the Nibelungen son Siegfried. Anyway, it talks about the cathedrals that were destroyed. I won't repeat all that. The churches, some of the destruction of these very old and valuable buildings. And then I'll continue. Eisenhower and Churchill, well, the last sentence here is, but now they got in the way of Montgomery's river crossing, these air raids. Eisenhower and Churchill were themselves both in attendance when three armies, 1,250,000 troops, gathered at the West Bank for the crossing with 60,000 tons of ammunition in their baggage. On the night of March 23rd, two divisions were supposed to cross under a barrage, and on March 24th, the Saturday before Palm Sunday, 14,000 paratroopers were to jump from above the mountain ranges north of Wesel to take out the gun emplacements controlling the Rhine. After consolidating the bridgehead, the command Canadian 1st, British 2nd, and U.S. 9th Armies could advance into the heart of the German Reich's industrial power. The massive effort of the undertaking alone prevented Montgomery from failing yet again to cross the Rhine. As Kleve and Emmerich had paid for the failure of Operation Market Garden, now Wesel and Zanten were to disappear to ensure success. That is why they had already been destroyed a month earlier, just to be sure. So they were already gone. The Germans had recognized that Wesel was a suitable location to cross the Rhine back in September 1944, when the British had tried to cross in Holland. They guessed they would return a bit further to the south. The place was one of the few in the Rhine Valley where a lower terrace that was protected from high water extended all the way to the river, making it possible to cross at any time. So the Germans quickly started digging trenches. In early 1945, the site was fortified and assigned a combat commander who committed himself in writing to hold out to the last man. After the destruction of Emmerich and Kleve, or could be Kleve, which could be heard as far as Wesel, the oppressive fear descended upon the people there. The authorities urged the residents to leave, but that was not taken seriously until February, when Operation Veritable launched the Battle of the Lower Rhine. On a sunny day, 8 days later, 100 Lancasters appeared above the town of 24,000. They returned in the afternoon. That evening, black smoke shrouded the town. It was dark, and emerging from the solid cellar vaults, dumbfounded residents could hardly see the rubble they were climbing on. They were also inadvertently walking on the corpses of men and horses that covered the pavement. On February 18th, the second raid started with 160 airplanes. most people had already left the city, but later returned, believing that the enemy would have no further interest in a dying city. While they were busy salvaging what they could of their possessions, they were caught in the third raid. Afterward, a sea of ash and dust blacked out the sun. It was the harshest of the attacks, but it struck mostly stone and found only very few people. The 562 corpses were lined up outside, and the city resolved not to expose them to the bombs any longer, but to bury them in the cemetery that very night. That turned out to be out of the question. They had to wait for the full moon, since it was impossible to transport anything through the rubble-filled streets in absolute darkness. The police captain in charge reported, and this is his part of his report, "Since no stretchers were available, we took planks out of the rubble and used wire or string to hold the corpses in place so they wouldn't fall as we climbed over the bumpy masses of debris. The task was arduous. We never finished because many squads could not find the bodies in the dark. At another location, the corpses were reburied in debris during a later raid and first had to be dug out again. Local farmers lent horses," and that's the end of the report. It's hailing out. "Local farmers lent horses and carriages to carry the corpses to the cemetery. The horses shied wildly when the raids resumed. It was very difficult to lead them to the cemetery. The funerals took place under strafer fire. Since there was a shortage of coffins, cloth was used. At the entrance to the cemetery, carts were piled high with corpses mutilated beyond recognition, and a handcart carried the bodies of children. On March 10th, there were still 1,900 people camping in the town. The formerly densely settled city center at the confluence of the Rhine and the Lippe was deserted, and no streets were recognizable. Only 60 buildings in this important port along the lower Rhine remained undamaged. St. Willibrord, the triple nave cathedral, whose construction started in 1424, stood as a ruin full of holes in a wasteland of debris. The artistic, articulated, gabled facades of the old commercial houses at the market square lay in heaps. In view of the fact that 97% of the city had been destroyed, 97%, residents were at first unable to decide whether Wesel should be abandoned or rebuilt. The highest number of deaths from the Allied missions to cross the Rhine on March 23rd must have been suffered by Dinslaken, a few miles to the southeast." Wow, it's awful loud out there. Wonder what this sounds like. "In order to shield the flank of the largest airborne operation of all time, the bombers had showered the town with phosphorus and high explosive bombs. The residents of the fully inhabited town had not been warned. The first series of bombs fell at around 9 a.m. The streets had been filled with lines of shoppers, and 700 people were wiped out, almost exclusively women and children. Fighter bombers pursued and fixed on the people fleeing eastward into the forests. Starting at 5 p.m., the 3,300 guns of 65 artillery battalions supposedly fired 2 million shells of various calibers on Wesel and its environs. That evening, again under a barrage, the landing mission was started from assault boats and amphibious tanks. It took 2 hours to fight down the resistance. On the morning of March 25th, the airborne landing followed. Churchill and Eisenhower together observed from the church tower in Ginderich what military superiority was capable of. Around noon, Churchill climbed onto the Rhine-Baben Bridge, which had been blasted by his enemy, and looked out toward Wesel to the raised watch on the Rhine. Within a week, every small town within the siege that was to form around the Ruhr Basin experienced the same fate. Fanatics dug themselves in everywhere. Child soldiers and the dutiful swore to bow to no one but death. In reality, these were self-sacrificing Hitler youth armed with Panzerfaust or bazookas. Commanders who distributed the weapon saw in it the invincibility of their kind. They took the rubble, the fire, and the explosiveness and inflammability of all that existed as proof of the mental granite. There was something that could not be broken. The unbreakable person throws his life away, so says Friedrich. But that he says hardly any of the besieged inhabitants along the Ruhr did that, but those who did not want to die lacked any countermeasure to do anything about it. The Allies' goal of unconditional surrender demanded that the populace would be terrorized by all available means for another 6 infernal weeks. Well, I'm going to say a few words here about... I wonder, Mike, how is the sound of the storm going? Is it interfering badly with the sound program, with the program? He's answering me here. It's loud, but okay, he says. Yeah, it's loud to me, too. Lots of hail coming down, hitting various things. So the unconditional surrender demand is which the Allies gave already at the very end of 1943 to both the Germans and the Japanese, and that was a hard decision by Roosevelt and his Jewish advisors, was really what caused this war to continue and to go to the destructive ends that it did, which is what they wanted. They wanted a completely demolished and defeated and supine Germany. But you see, no nation, when historians and others talk about why didn't Germany make some arrangement, why didn't they surrender, why did they keep holding out, no soldier, you can't surrender unconditionally. Nobody surrenders unconditionally. And no decent soldier or no leader of men, a military leader, will agree to surrender unconditionally. They never do. And Jodl made that comment during the Nuremberg trials, and in which he explained that they couldn't in any good faith. And that was known. They couldn't surrender unconditionally. The Japanese wouldn't do it either. We know now that the Japanese were working, trying very hard to find a way to surrender before those atomic bombs fell on them, but Roosevelt wouldn't accept anything. So and the same with, we know that Hitler was always trying to work out some kind of a peace deal. He couldn't surrender unconditionally to the Allies and to the Soviet Union and so on, but he was trying to work out something with the British and Americans, but they just continually rejected it. So this comes down to the desire of Britain and the United States to smash the Germans for good, forever. And today, Germany is a nation that is under occupation still. So they really did get what they wanted, and Germany has to do what they're told. If you think Germany is in charge of anything for its own internal purposes, only things that don't really matter. Otherwise, it is it has to do as it's told. So I'll skip a page now and read a paragraph about Essen to finish up. In the so-called Battle of the Ruhr, Essen, Duisburg, Dortmund, Cologne, and Bochum had been plowed through again the previous fall. On October 23rd and 25th, 1944, a total of 1,800 planes dropped more than 8,000 tons of bombs on Essen, a city that, according to Bomber Command, no longer contained any combustibles. Just in case, though, more than 1 million incendiary sticks were released. 1,482 people died, including 225 prisoners and foreign workers. On the night of December 12th, Bomber Command killed another 463 residents. There was a direct hit on the prison that failed to blast it open. The staff was able to flee, but 200 inmates in the men's wing were buried in their cells and not dug out alive. The last major raid on Essen was on March 11th. The two prongs of the Ruhr encirclement had already been released. Double the tonnage used at Hamburg was dropped, 4,660 tons, and 897 people went to their graves. Now, here's a quote from Thecla O., who lived in Essen. She wrote to her mother 3 months later. She said, "The raid on March 11th was like nothing else. That we survived it in the shelters was truly an act of God. There were several minutes between each drop, then all hell would break loose again. No one said a word, but every once in a while I asked during a break if everyone was still there. The end of the world can't be any worse." The next day, the end of the world moved to Dortmund. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of my reading for tonight. And I'll be back in a few minutes after this news break, so stay with me. This is Carolyn Yeager.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Reacting to being cut off by the SWIFT banking system, Iran has now threatened to block the Strait of Hormuz, a major artery in global oil shipping. Now, that warning comes as U.S. and Israeli intelligence agencies, the CIA and Mossad, admit that Iran hasn't yet decided to develop nuclear weapons. Well, let's discuss this in depth now with Peter Rushton. He's a political analyst and historian, joining me live there in London. Well, Iran's been threatening for quite a while to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. Could we really see this happen now?
Well, I think what we're seeing at the moment has been is the culmination of a long-term effort by Iran's enemies to force the Iranian government into a corner, to force them into a position where they're left with an invidious choice between, on the one hand, having to steer a course between, on the one hand, seeming to be bullied and giving in and appearing weak, and on the other hand, allowing themselves to be provoked and allowing themselves to be forced into a confrontational position.
And the reasons
what we've
for
seen today with these financial.
Oh, sorry, just to ask you, the reasons for pushing Iran into the corner, all of it based on the supposed nuclear ambitions there. Now, as I've just mentioned, Mossad, the Israeli spy agency, is now joining the CIA in admitting that Iran has not decided to develop nuclear weapons. What do you make of that turn in events?
Well, that was an extraordinary development, particularly in a very detailed story that appeared in the New York Times on Sunday. Now, those stories don't appear by accident. And I think what that reflects is the reaction of professionals in the intelligence community, diplomatic and intelligence professionals, who once again are having their reports, having their work abused for political and ideological reasons. There's a political, ideological agenda in Washington and Tel Aviv, to an extent here in London as well, to willfully misinterpret intelligence, to slant or to spin, to use the term that's become used recently, to spin intelligence in a direction that forces people on the path to war. We saw it in Iraq, where there were absolutely disastrous consequences from the intelligence process being abused, and I think we're seeing it now here in Iran, and the development on Sunday, where certain people, certain individuals spoke out, of course on condition of anonymity, senior people in the intelligence services, who once again can see their work being undone, all their years of professional work being undone by a politically motivated ideological agenda of special interest groups driving the agenda.
Does that not suggest some sort of internal conflict going on in Israel when we see Israeli politicians simply ignoring their intelligence agency?
Yes, well, of course, as far as Israel's concerned, there's been a conflict.
Yeah.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just sending a message here. Thank you for putting up with that. I've still got my rain going on, but it's not quite as bad right at the moment as it was. This is Carolyn Yeager. I'm bringing you the Heretics Hour tonight. I did my reading, and you know, with all that noise, with all that storm, it's kind of, when you're trying to do something else, it's kind of, what I'm trying to do is a little bit disturbing, and I thought, well, this is absolutely nothing compared to what people experience when they go through bombs dropping on them, like I've been reading about every week. Really, really awful. You know, what is a little storm? Not much. All right. I'm going to play a few clips, three clips during this second half hour. So I'm just giving Mike a little warning to get those ready. And on to the topic of what's most often called the Gliwice incident. I'd like to put an end to this false story, but I probably cannot do it. I mean, I realize that as many other people have tried to do it. Some very outstanding names, like David Hogan, the revisionist historian, David Irving, another historian, Carlos Porter has written about it. And 2 weeks ago, Mark Weber did his program right here on VOR on the myths about how World War II was started, and he brought up Gliwice and concluded there was no credibility for it being any kind of a false flag, and he mentioned his favorite mainstream historians. But I want to confront the internet talk radio personalities, because probably more people listen to Alex Jones' radio and TV broadcasts than read AJP Taylor. And what does Alex Jones say about it? Well, Alex Jones gave a keynote speech in Chicago in 2006 at a 9/11 conference of some sort. And this is from the description on his website, Infowars.com. This is his notes. Well, this is taken from it. Somebody wrote this up. Alex Jones, and it was posted on Alex Jones' website. Alex Jones started out by going through a PowerPoint presentation on the history of government-sponsored terrorism. This section of the presentation covered in great detail such things as events in ancient Rome, Hitler's Reichstag fire, Hitler and the Gliwice incident, and the overthrow of Mossadegh, Operation Northwoods, the Gulf of Tonkin, the USS Liberty, the Oklahoma City bombing, and the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. So, you know, he puts all these things together as government-sponsored terrorism or government false flag operations to get the people to go along with one thing or another, usually some kind of war. And so it's easy to believe when you find these things thrown in there, amongst other things that really are false flags, it's easy to believe that they are too. And this is how this kind of business, this is one way it works. More thunder coming. So it says here that Alex went into great depth into each of these sections and really showed off his command of the subject matter. Well, I'm telling you, you know, he has no command of the subject matter about many of the things he talks about. So what I'd say, he was really showing off his ignorance of the subject matter. But then on his website, I found another little page that gave 10 false flag operations that shaped our world. Now, he didn't write this, but he posted it on InfoWars. And, you know, his motto is, because there is a war going on for your mind. Well, he's into that war for your mind. He wants to control your mind, and he is playing with your mind. So the number 5 false flag operation of the 10 that are on that page is the fake invasion at Gliwice. And he writes on there, I'll just one little quote from it, from Nauyuk's signed statement. In the late evening of Thursday, August 31st, 1939, German covert operatives pretending to be Polish terrorists seized the Gliwice radio station in the German-Poland border region of Silesia. Well, so this is what he says actually did happen. And I'm going to show you tonight that didn't happen. It really couldn't have happened, and there's no evidence that it happened. But now I'm going to ask Mike to play the first clip. It is I want you to listen to Alex's special brand of mind control in this excerpt, because this is from his video Terror Storm. It's just one little section about Gliwice. It's called Terror Storm, Second Edition, A History of Government-Sponsored Terrorism. And the blurb for the program says, in Alex Jones' film, this is a must-see for those who want to know the real truth behind many of the devastating terrorist attacks and other government-sponsored false flag events of the past. You won't get this information from the corporate-controlled media, whose main job is to keep the truth from you. This is by far the best documentary that Jones has made to date, and it is well documented. Okay, let's see how well documented it is. Mike, would you please play this short clip?
By March of 1939, Hitler had already seized Czechoslovakia. Having gained both Austria and Czechoslovakia, Hitler desired to move east against Poland, but he did not want to look like the aggressor. Hitler needed an excuse for attacking Poland. It was Heinrich Himmler who came up with the plan. Thus, the operation was codenamed Operation Himmler. On the night of August 31st, 1939, the Germans took an unknown prisoner from one of the concentration camps, dressed him in a Polish uniform, took him to the town of Gliwice on the German-Polish border, and then shot him. The stage scene with the dead prisoner dressed in a Polish uniform was supposed to appear as a Polish attack against the German radio station. German radio, newspapers, and newsreels were flooded with images of what appeared to be a dead Polish soldier who had dared attack the Reich. Now Hitler had his excuse to invade Poland, and the nightmare of World War II had begun.
Okay. Now, you should see some of you may have seen this film, and some of you may have it, and you may think it's just really great. But the pictures that are shown with this part have nothing to do, in large part, with what's said. You know, this is how they do in videos. They just, and in movies, they show images, and they have the narrative, and then they show these images, which give you an idea of what it means, what they're saying, but they don't fit together. This is called disinformation, folks. And of course, you know that. Now, in the case of Gliwice, whatever happened or didn't happen there, it did not start or cause the invasion of Poland by Germany, nor did it start World War II or anything of the kind. This narrative was and is, in fact, an invention to give the prosecutors at Nuremberg a cause for accusing Germany of starting World War II. It was the Allied governments who needed a pretext, not Hitler. It was an Allied government who needed a pretext for blaming the entire war on Germany, and this was one part of it. I'm going to say more about that later, but right now I'm just continuing with the Internet people. The new crime that they invented following the war, that actually their Jewish lawyers came up with, was the crimes against peace. And this is where they brought this in, under crimes against peace. So they could accuse the National Socialists of aggressing against peace. This crime didn't exist during the war. It was made afterwards, so which is also not really allowable, but they did it. And this Gliwice story was made to order for that. So it could take your attention away from the reality that it was the Allied governments who really started World War II. Now, I'll just say that false flags are extremely popular in conspiratorial theory. So whatever looks like one is included in the list, especially if it can be tied to Hitler. And there are a lot of people who really like conspiratorial theories of history, and I myself we all get into that. We all get into the truth through that means, I think, in large part, most of us. And so, but I have come to be much more critical of conspiracy theories than I used to be, and some are very good and some are kind of half-baked. So, moving on, let's look at another talk show host who loves to mention the Gliwice false flag incident that Hitler used to start World War II by invading Poland, and that is Michael Rivero, who is back on RBN middays on Monday through Friday. I've got two clips of Rivero from his debut February 20th show, coming back to RBN. I just thought I would. I don't listen to his show generally. I don't listen to that much. Only certain things do I listen to now. But sometimes I will go and find out. And this was his first show, so I thought, well, I wonder what he's going to say. And I heard this. I heard part of this. And I remembered it, so I went back and found it for tonight's show. And the first is only 10 seconds long. It's from 17 minutes into the first hour. Mike, would you please play that clip?
Anybody who wants to start a war, they got to start it with a lie. They're coming to get us. Look how Hitler got World War II going. Send his own people to attack the radio station in Gliwice, Germany, and blame Poland for it.
Well, that's something that you hear Mike Rivero saying quite often. Every time he talks about false flags and government-sponsored, same thing that, I don't know if he calls it government-sponsored terrorism, but it's the same thing Alex Jones talks about. And a lot of it is, he has a lot of basis for it, but he's always throwing in this thing, this Gliwice, and he also throws in the Reichstag fire, which I don't have time to talk about tonight, but that's another one, though other people have taken care of that quite well, and debunked that. But so this is real common to hear Mike Rivero say this, what you just heard. Now, a minute later in this program, he gets a call from a caller who challenges him on this, and we hear how Rivero handles it. So this is about a minute. So play this one next, Mike, please.
And also, I want to know why you're going off on Hitler all the time. I never hear you say anything about Stalin. What are the Ashkenazi Jews to you? I mean, what are they to you? I mean,
well,
explain that to me.
The reason I go off on Hitler is because our propaganda organs are always attempting to use Hitler as the justification for everything that they're doing. I mean, they compare Ahmadinejad to Hitler. They talk about the new Holocaust coming out of Iran. Stalin just doesn't get the press that Hitler does. I'm personally sick and tired of hearing about the guy. I don't go to movies that have Nazis and Hitler in them. It's the first half of the last century, and it really is outdated history, and we've got genocides and problems to deal with today. But basically what I try and do is grab the imagery coming from the current propaganda and to turn it back on them.
Well, what happened then, which he didn't include, was that then the music came. It was time for a break, and he says, well, it's time for a break. Thanks for your call. And he cut the guy off. I mean, not that I don't end calls myself. But he didn't tell this caller that he'd hold him over, over the break, or he'd continue to talk to him about it, because he didn't really want to be challenged on this at all, and he was glad that the break came up and saved him from it. When he came back, this was never mentioned again on the rest of the program. No word of Hitler. He dropped that. He really dropped that for the rest of that program. But he's trying to sound reasonable. And he's good at sounding reasonable, but did his answer make any sense? You'd have to listen to it maybe a couple of times to realize that what did he actually say? He says he's not interested in anything to do with the Nazis, but he's constantly bringing up the Nazis, and everybody knows it. And this guy, I asked him about it. Why do you keep doing that? And then he says, well, I'm doing it because it's in the culture, and I just try to grab what's in the culture to make my point. Well, I can't say that. I guess his point is false flags, and he thinks that's a good way, but I don't believe that at all, because he doesn't have to talk about the Nazis. He doesn't have to use, say, Gliwice to make the point about false flags. He could talk about other false flags, particularly Israel's false flags, which he does sometimes. But I could say, the reason he doesn't, the reason he does this is because he's a Jew. Mike Rivero is Jewish, and he doesn't want to talk about the Jews. And he doesn't talk about the Jews. He talks about Israel, and he'll talk sometimes about Ashkenazis or something. But he tries to distinguish between he distinguishes, of course, between Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews. But I don't want to get into that. I just want to say that it's the Jews who want to point the finger at Hitler all the time. It's the Jews who want to do that. And so because he's a Jew, he has to go along with that. He's being loyal to his Jewish tribe in constantly going after Hitler. Well, you might say, well, then Alex Jones doing? He's not Jewish. Well, that's true. But Alex Jones works for Jews. He works for the Jews. He's got so many Jewish connections. It's not even funny. So even though he himself, I suppose, is not Jewish, he is still doing what they want done. So now in the second hour of this program, on the 27th. Sorry, I lost my place here. That program was on the 20th. On February 27th, in the first hour, around the 45 minutes, he said that Mike Rivero said that the boycott of German goods in 1933 was caused by the global bankers. And he says that all other countries with central banks, they didn't want their people to see how well the Germans did because of instituting their own banking. So he says they all got together and instigated World War II. All the central bank nations did. That's true. But again, you see how he avoids ever mentioning that they're Jewish, that they're mostly Jewish bankers. He just calls them global bankers and central bank nations. And at 58 minutes, he said that he was talking about U.S. foreign policy. And he said an excuse to conquer the world, global government, well, that's what Hitler wanted. Maybe this time we'll get it. Well, there again, he throws Hitler in there. How many people, are there any people who really did want to conquer the world? It certainly wasn't Hitler. He was not out to conquer any world, and he certainly didn't want global government. He's just the opposite. He hated global government and globalists. He wanted nationalist governments. So in that February 27th program, talking about U.S. in the second hour of that program, 46 minute and 30 second mark, he's talking about U.S. cops, and he says, even the Nazis were not this bad. They were internally consistent. Well, that was a little bit of a offhand compliment. But you see, he wants us to hate the cops. Now, at the 48 minute mark, a couple minutes later, he says, again, global government, that's what Alexander the Great wanted. That's what Napoleon wanted, and that's what Hitler wanted. It didn't work out very well for the ordinary people. By ordinary people, he means Jews and other non-whites, like himself. He doesn't mean white people. Notice he selects three great white leaders of Western civilization who, by the way, didn't want global government. He wants us to dislike Alexander the Great. He wants us to dislike Napoleon. He wants us to dislike Hitler and see them all as bad guys. These are great names in white Western civilization. But he wants us to be concerned with the ordinary people, who are a mixed multicultural group of people. And this to me is terribly disingenuous, and it's kind of tricky. Now, here at the 49-minute mark, 1 minute later, he's talking about Occupy Wall Street and saying that a disruptor who is shouting, the Jews this, the Jews that, Rivero says, well, we know corporate Wall Street hired these disruptors to present Occupy Wall Street as a communist and capitalist movement. But he says that Occupy Wall Street is anti-fascist and anti-war, and he thinks the current USA is fascist. He always uses the word fascist. He will never use any other word. So in spite of his protests, he wants to portray fascism, Nazism, National Socialism, Hitlerism, and Italian fascism, whatever. He wants to portray them as corporatism. He wants to say that they are in league with the corporations, which was not the case, certainly not with with Hitler, and not mention really the Jews or the communists. Just like he said, oh, nobody talks about Stalin. They only talk about Hitler. So that's why I talk about Hitler. That's why I use Hitler, because that's the way people think. That's how I can get my point across. See, this is all, none of this has anything to do with Gleiwitz, which I'm going to get into in the second hour and explain all that, as I promised. But I just found, since I was into this program, I just found all these little things quite interesting, and I couldn't resist mentioning them. Now, another person, there's just any number of people on the internet and who have talk radio programs or who just write articles and so on, who repeat this Gleiwitz thing. And a lot of them are Jews or associated with Jews. I just happened to come across, I was looking up false flag Gleiwitz stuff, Stephen Lindman, who a lot of people think very highly of. He's certainly Jewish. He writes articles. And he wrote one May 7th, 2011, less than a year ago, and he wrote in there, there's an article on false flags, he wrote, on August 31st, 1939, Nazis impersonating Polish terrorists attacked the Gleiwitz radio station on the border between the two countries, starting World War II. Now, speaking about research, these people are all supposed to be great researchers, you know, I've had people tell me in emails they send to me that Mike Rivero is a great researcher. And, of course, people think that Alex Jones is a great researcher. You hear that quite often. He says it. People tell him that on his program. People say that about him. Oh, well, he does great research. Well, I don't know. If these people are researchers and Stephen Lindman is supposed to do research to write his articles – if these people are doing research, you're going to see that it's very easy to find out the truth of the Gleiwitz incident. Very easy. And so the fact that they don't have it and don't express it, don't speak it, is because they don't want to. They don't care about what the truth is. They have an agenda. They have certain things they want to say, and it's all anti-Hitler, anti-Nazism, because they're all Jews. So that's my point there. Now I'm going to have just a few minutes left before the hour break, but I'm going to start telling you about the background of this Gleiwitz affair. And I just luckily happened to come across a neat article on German Views this past week. And it is kind of a review or part of an article about someone who wrote, a German who wrote about the causes and Allied history policy of the outbreak of war in 1939, part one. There's going to be more of it. Anyway, I'm quoting from there about the Nuremberg tribunals, because this is where it all started, or this is where this story really got formed. Now, Robert H. Jackson, I hope you know that Robert H. Jackson was the head U.S. representative at the Nuremberg tribunals. He was a Supreme Court judge. He was selected by President Franklin Roosevelt to go to Nuremberg and head the legal team of the United States in prosecuting the Germans, which was very political, of course, very important how this was handled. And he had confidence in this Robert H. Jackson. So he had formerly been a U.S. Attorney General, Jackson, and he was very much willing to serve President Roosevelt in the legal protection of the American war policy. And now that he was sent to Europe, he knew that it was necessary to set an official end to the conflict. This was what the instructions were given. They were going there to set an official end to the conflict and to state once and for all that Germany alone was to be blamed for the Second World War. Everybody knew that that was what had to be accomplished. Germany alone had to be blamed for the Second World War. And while he was there, once he got there, he realized and knew well and emphasized that the German declaration of war in the United States was perfectly legal. Okay, we will go on with this, ladies and gentlemen, after another news break. So stay with me. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Feature story news in Washington. I'm Simon Marks. French police say Monday's shooting at a Jewish school in Toulouse has been linked to the killing of three soldiers in the area last week. Four people were killed outside the school on Monday morning. Authorities are searching for the attacker. From FSN's bureau in Paris, Kate Moody reports.
Authorities say one of the guns used outside the Ozar HaTorah school was also fired in two shootings last week. On all three occasions, an assailant opened fire and sped away on a motorbike. Three French soldiers were killed in last week's attacks. A rabbi, his two sons, and a young schoolgirl died in Toulouse. One witness described the gunman as targeting young children outside the school and, quote, looking to kill. Those killed at the school had dual French-Israeli citizenship and are expected to be buried in Israel, while the paratroopers killed last week were Arab or black and had recently fought in Afghanistan. Police are investigating a possible terrorist link, but the motives for all three incidents remain unclear. Kate Moody, Paris.
The French President Nicolas Sarkozy says the shooting of the teacher and three children outside that school in Toulouse is a national tragedy, speaking here through a translator.
Of course, we're thinking about the family that is hurting, thinking about the mother who has lost her two children and her husband on the same day, thinking about the director of the school who witnessed all this tragedy. This barbarism, this savagery, this cruelty will never triumph.
Staff Sergeant Robert Bales, the U.S. soldier who allegedly shot 16 Afghan civilians in Kandahar 10 days ago, has met his lawyer for the first time. The encounter took place at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, where Staff Sergeant Bales is being held. His attorney, John Henry Brown, says friends and family members are baffled by what Sergeant Bales allegedly did.
It was a shock, believe me, more of a shock perhaps to them and the neighbors, even reading all the news accounts. I mean, everybody thinks he's a very nice person, a very mild-mannered person, and a great person.
European leaders are condemning the execution of two men in Belarus who were convicted of carrying out a bomb attack on the underground system in the capital Minsk. From FSN's bureau in Brussels, Vanessa Mock reports.
There's been widespread condemnation in Europe of these executions. The EU foreign policy chief Catherine Ashton has condemned the move, saying the two men had not been accorded due legal process. The German government said they would put a further strain on ties between the EU and Belarus. The two 25-year-old men were sentenced to death over a bomb attack last April that killed 15 people and wounded hundreds of others. Dmitry Konovalov was found guilty of carrying out the explosion and Vladislav Kovalyov of assisting him. But Kovalyov withdrew his testimony, explaining he'd given evidence to investigators under duress. The former Soviet state is the only nation in Europe that still uses capital punishment. Vanessa Mock, Brussels.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Well, good evening again, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back. We're in the second hour now of this stormy broadcast that I'm doing. There's a lot of thunder and lightning out there, and I just hope I can get through this next hour without my internet going down or something. I hope not. I feel lucky. So I want to tell you that this is the call-in hour, and the number is 1-855-477-2283. Let me give the Gleiwitz story here, and then you are welcome to call in with anything you think should be added or any questions or comments that you have. I was telling you that Robert Jackson had gone to Europe to head the U.S. legal team at Nuremberg to make sure that Germany alone was blamed for the Second World War. And that he realized that that the German declaration of war on the United States is perfectly legal, so they couldn't use that. Therefore, Jackson pointed out before the court, the war in Europe had to be shown. No, he pointed out to the other legal eagles, not before the court, but before they got to the court, that the war in Europe had to be shown to have been, from the beginning, a German aggression contrary to international law. In other words, this new law they had made, which was called Crimes Against Peace. Now, this turned out to be easily said but difficult to prove. Thorough study of files had made Jackson increasingly doubt that there was a chance that a fair trial would support in any way the assertion of Germany's exclusive responsibility. On the contrary, and this is a quote, the Germans, from him, obviously, the Germans will certainly accuse our three European allies to have pursued a policy that has enforced the war. I say this because the seized documents from the German Foreign Office, which I have seen, all come to the same.
Well, about that Gleiwitz incident, interesting thing. As far as I know, the only evidence for that whole story is the Nuremberg testimony of Alfred Naujax.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, Hadding. Hold on here, because I'm going to get to that. And so let me just go at it in the way I was going at it. And I can do this now because I've got my page back up, although all they're trying to bring back all this stuff. I have to get rid of all this stuff that it's trying to bring back that I had. Good grief. All right. I'm sorry, listeners, for this. So I was saying that Jackson said that the documents, and you comment with this as you want to, Hadding, okay?
All right.
The documents from the German Foreign Office, which because if I lose my, if I lose my connection, you can keep the listeners company. Which it come to the conclusion, and this is what he said, that the Germans were thinking, what their motivations were. They said in quotes, in quotes, we have no escape. We must fight. We are surrounded. We are strangled. Everything from the German Foreign Office showed that the Germans felt that they were defending themselves, that they couldn't avoid fighting, that they couldn't, you know, they were being surrounded and strangled. And so he says, how would a judge react if this is found in the trial? And he said, I think before I condemn anyone as the aggressor, he ought to describe his motives. And that would be catastrophic, Jackson continued, because if this trial leads to a discussion of the political and economic causes of the war, this may cause infinite damage, both in Europe, which I do not know well, and in America that I know fairly well. So ultimately, those prospects only spurred him on. So he planned his perfect trial. This is still from this person who, this German new research that's been done, and some new documents I think have revealed this. Who wrote this on German views? Jackson planned his perfect trial as a legislator and carried it successfully through as a prosecutor by simply banning any discussion on the causes of the war before the Nuremberg Tribunal. Nothing was found on the war policies of the West, Poland, or the USSR, since almost all the documents and testimonies that would have been relevant in this respect were rejected by the court as irrelevant. So that all those relevant documents were rejected as irrelevant. So they didn't have a fair trial. He said a fair trial would not support what they wanted to do. So they decided not to have a fair trial. And that's how that goes. So that is why the testimony of this Naryuk was presented. And that is really, like you just said, the only thing that is that is based on. And it's quite shady.
Supposedly that's some special information that you can't get except from these conspiracy theorists like Alex Jones. But I had a history survey course where the professor spouted that nonsense, and I didn't really believe it at the time. But I looked into it since then.
You weren't in a position to speak to question it. Right.
Well, it seems a very suspicious story on its face because, you know, there's this notion that was propagated about Germany that people in the government could just do anything and not be accountable. You know, I do not believe that the German authorities could take some prisoner and just kill him at their whim and not have to answer to anybody.
No. But there are people who do believe that, so we have to go at this even with even more evidence against it. And I'm going to skip a little part here because I've wasted so much time with about the background, which has already been gone over, and I've gone over it on this program with Wilhelm Christmann, some programs, and with Professor Andreas Wesserle on some programs that are in the archives, and even Weber went over it in that program he did 2 weeks ago. So there was this determination of Poland, you know, to retake their German lands and so on. But what's important here that I can bring in that's new tonight is that the Allied version of this Gleiwitz incident was written by someone named H.S. Hegner, and every account, the revisionist Bochaca, is that how you pronounce his name? Bochaca or Bochaca? I don't have it in front of me. He used this, and he said that this account is from this person named H.S. Hegner. H.S. Hegner, H-E-G-N-E-R. And I started looking him up just almost right before the program. And he turns out H.S. Hegner is a pseudonym for Harry Schulze Wilde. And he wrote something called Death. Treja Rica, 1933-1945. It's by this Harry Schulze Wilde, which is a pseudonym. And this means the Third Reich, 1933-1945. And I guess, I think that's Swedish or Norwegian, something like that. But I couldn't find out what it was, what that language was. But it hasn't. Anyway, that's all I could find out about H.S. Hegner. But he gave the story out that Heinrich Mueller, you know, the general story, a high functionary in the Gestapo, had been tasked by someone, maybe Hitler, maybe, you know, somebody high up, with concocting an official motive for Germany's declaring war on Poland. And because they seem, the whole story is that Germany needed a pretext to attack Poland. They didn't want to appear to be an aggressor. Well, you know, all this had been going on, as our listeners should really know, for a year, for even way before that. But in the 6 months leading up to September 1st, 1939, Hitler had been in negotiations, trying to negotiate with Poland and with Britain and even with France in so many ways to try to work out these problems with Poland. And more and more it became apparent that they didn't want to work out these problems. They were the ones who were creating a pretext. They were the ones who were trying to get Hitler to move into Poland. And
nobody expected that Germany would turn out to be as powerful in the war as they were. And if you go back and read what people were writing in September 1939, they were saying, Poland can hold out for years, right? That's what people thought.
That's right. We've got a couple more callers, but I don't know if I should let one of them on and see who he is. There's still a lot I'd like to say. But, Mike, if you want to put somebody else on the line rather than have them just keep holding, go ahead. Now, so this story, I'll just give the story real quick. It was that from on high, Heinrich Mueller was tasked by, and really by, well, I'll go into that later, was tasked to create some kind of incident there, and he was supposed to take 100, he came up with this idea, I guess, he concocted it, 100 prisoners from German concentration camps were taken to the city of Opeln, which was next to the, which is now Opel, next to the Polish frontier. And they were put into German SS uniforms and posted near the frontier. They were surprise attacked by German soldiers dressed in Polish uniforms, and then he murdered those prisoners dressed in German uniforms to make it appear that the Poles had killed all these German soldiers, and that would make the German people very angry when they put that information, that publicity out. And they would just be ready to go to war with Poland. Well, this part of the story kind of disappeared because it's not really the Gliwice story, but it is another part of it where supposedly there were dead German soldiers all along the border, and it is true that German soldiers were killed in these skirmishes and so on, and it was always the Polish irregulars that were coming across the border in these raids, and they'd been doing it for some time. So this was one part of it. But the part that affects us is that Germans in Polish uniforms next headed toward the Polish frontier. Wait a minute. They went to the Polish frontier, and they occupied and burned down their own German customs post in Hohelinde. And that's the other aspect of this, that the customs house in Hohelinde, and then the radio station in Gliwice. And then a Gestapo agent named Naujuk, in command of German soldiers disguised as members of the Polish, he was supposed to be one of the ones in a Polish uniform, attacked a German radio station in Gliwice. There was supposedly one fatality. And this was a prisoner wearing a Polish military uniform who was found dead there. Now, this is the story from H.S. Hegner, which is the story that many people tell, that this one dead person was wearing a Polish military uniform. But when we go to what Naujuk says in his affidavit, he says that this person was dressed in civilian clothing, and he was a prisoner from a concentration camp that was killed by an injection by a doctor, or given an injection by a doctor, and then given over to him while he was still alive, and then he planted him outside the building of the radio station, and then somehow he got gunshots, but he says that he already had the gunshots on him.
He
didn't shoot him. So the whole thing gets very, very confusing. Now, what the Germans said at the time was that the police chief in Gliwice reported that the Gliwice radio station had been assaulted by irregular Polish troops, who for a moment succeeded in occupying the station before they were chased out by the German frontier police. And apparently, while they were in there, they said a few things over the radio in Polish. And one Polish irregular was mortally wounded. Well, if he was an irregular, he would be dressed in civilian clothing, right? Because they weren't dressed in uniform. And then the communication from a representative of the town of Tropal about the custom house of Hohelinde was also a report made that night. and said that the customs house of Holendy was attacked by Polish irregulars who succeeded in occupying it. But thanks to a counterattack by the auxiliary troops, they were routed. And but the point is that these attacks by these Polish irregulars were a fairly common occurrence by now. And when they would make these raids across the border, and they often stole things. You know, they stole anything that was valuable to them. They would steal machinery, or they would steal military things that could, you know, that they could use. They would rob. They would kill German people. They would sometimes shoot at German troops if they saw them. They would, or they thought they could get away with it. They did all kinds of damage. They were a serious problem. But they've been doing that, and they're doing it kind of all along the border. I don't really know what was on the border, but probably some places they did it more because there was something to go after there. But they were prosecuting terrorism against the Germans, and this is one of the reasons why the Germany finally declared war and went into Poland that at 4 a.m. that morning of September 1st. So
these
things. Go ahead.
There's supposed to be 21 incidents. So, you know, the Gleiwitz incident is one out of 21 similar incidents.
I think that very night. I think that very night they had 21 reports.
Yeah, I think so.
And then other days, you know, for the last few months, and it just kept getting worse because the fact is the Poles were determined once the British and the French signed this guarantee for them, which I didn't talk about. I just skipped over that, but people should know that they did that. Once the Poles got that, then they just wanted war with Germany because they really believed, like you said, that the Germans didn't have that good of a military, and that with the help of those allies on the other side of Germany, Germany would just be cowed, and they would just march in and take over Berlin, and that was their dream. And they were not at all in touch with reality about all of that.
Yes, the Poles also had a very overinflated sense of their own greatness because they had defeated the Soviet Union in the early 1920s and annexed some Ukrainian territory. So they sort of regarded themselves as a great power. And people forget, this is something that, I mean, I understand why people forget it because it's not mentioned, that the Poles also annexed part of Czechoslovakia.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's all that. And, you know, that's all true. I don't want to go into all that now because I've just decided to not to because I can't tell the whole story of Gleiwitz. And what I want to do is get to the very bottom of the Gleiwitz. But all of that is true. I mean, but the fact is that doesn't mean that Gleiwitz is not true. No matter how badly the Poles behaved and how far out they were in their thinking, but the fact is what actually happened here. And is there somebody? Is there another person on the line? How many people are on this line?
I thought he brought up a third person. It sounds like somebody has a radio playing in the background or something.
Yeah, it's not working too well. Mike, maybe you better turn that off. Okay, let's see how we can move ahead here. All right. If we compare the two texts, the one from this H.S. Hegner and the official German report, we will see that, whoops, oh, my light just flickered. If the Germans had disguised prisoners in SS uniforms and afterwards killed them to show outraged Germans that their boys had been done in, there can be no reasonable doubt that it would have been with the goal of making the event known, whether by photographs or by written documents. Now, Alex Jones said in that terror video of his that, oh, that this information was plastered all over Germany, you know, the next day and afterwards about this attack by this phony attack by the Poles. Well, I believe that no such thing was ever done. As far as I can find out, the Germans didn't say much of anything about this. When Hitler went to make his speech to the German people that very day on September 1st, after they had declared war on Poland at 4 a.m. and moved in there. A little bit later, he made a speech to the people, and he didn't even mention this. He didn't mention these things because everybody knew what the Poles had been doing, so he didn't need to mention it. Now, if this was the pretext for the war, wouldn't he have told the people about how this happened and how these Poles had taken over the radio station? And if this is what was supposed to be give him justification for doing this, for doing what he was doing? See, it doesn't make any sense. And so, and there's no official version about this either. Not in the French Yellow Book, not in Churchill's memoirs. No, nobody writes about this. It's just this funny. It's just at Nuremberg, just like so many of these things at Nuremberg. They only come up there.
And it's now, interesting. It's interesting about Naujox too. He survived Nuremberg. He wasn't executed or anything.
Oh yeah.
You know, you think.
Yeah, let's go to that story with him. That's another thing. I mean, that totally discredits the whole thing. But the fact is that the war crimes were committed by Poland, not Germany, because their troops were making incursions into German territory, even though they were irregular. But they had the blessing of the regular troops, and they.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, it is an interesting day today, March 19th. First of all, today marks 10 years since the end of Operation Anaconda, Afghanistan. This was the first large-scale, non-special operations battle for U.S. troops in Afghanistan since the war started. The mission? To destroy al-Qaeda and Taliban forces. It would not be the last, and many more would be launched for the very same reason. Today is also the 9th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, a war that lasted 8.5 years, cost tens of thousands of lives, I'm not even going to tell you how much money, and leaves many people today still pretty confused about its mission. And today also marks 1 year since U.S. and NATO forces launched airstrikes in Libya. About the mission itself, the case for war was made using R2P, the responsibility to protect. It wasn't regime change, but that indeed is what happened. And we also heard predictions like weeks, not months, in terms of a timeline for Libya. It took a lot longer, as we know now. So today we want to take a look back at the history and look ahead to the consequences. David Swanson is a campaigner with Roots Action. He's in Charlottesville, Virginia, to help us dissect this. David, let's start with Libya. 1 year later, what was solved there?
It is remarkable indeed that we have so many wars that the anniversaries pile up on top of each other now. I don't want the 10,000s of deaths in the war in Iraq to go without comment. By any rational calculations, over 1 million deaths, we have to include the Iraqis along with the Americans. In Libya, we indeed saw a war launched without Congress, with an intent on avoiding any authorization from Congress whatsoever, although it could easily have been had. A war launched on the basis of a UN resolution that did not authorize regime change, but that was used for regime change, so that we now have humanitarian warriors pushing for war in Syria and elsewhere, arguing that the UN got NATO into Libya for regime change when it did no such thing. We have Libya held up now, along with Kosovo and the first Gulf War, as a good war, as a humanitarian war. And no explanation of the number of lives killed by NATO and by the U.S. in the process, the lawlessness of the war, the lawlessness of murdering the ruler of a country, and the chaos that resulted, so that there is no expectation in the foreseeable future of a stable democracy with protection for human rights in Libya, as might have been predicted from the fact that we've never achieved such a thing with our bombs before.
And you were talking a little bit about how there are some people who are using Libya as an example for why, you know, when we are protecting citizens, that action is a good thing. But there's another legacy here as well that seems to be.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am on my telephone because I just don't want to put too much stress on the computer because of the storm I'm experiencing here. And so I might sound a little different to you, but we're in our last half hour, and Hadding from Florida has called in, and he's here on the line with me. And I want to now cover the testimony or the affidavit of Alfred Nauyuk at the Nuremberg trial, because it's his testimony which is what is officially makes this story supposedly an official truth. And it's very questionable. So I can do that easily in this last half hour, and then we'll still have time to discuss it a little bit. So let me just say that in November of 1944, Nauyuk, well, there's a little background on him. You know, he was in the SS. Where do I have that? Okay, in 1941, he was in the SS since 1933, and he was in the SD since... pretty much when it started. And that was under Reinhard Heydrich. And in 1941, before Heydrich was assassinated, he was dismissed by, and this Nauyuk was dismissed by Heydrich from the SD, and he was demoted at that time for something he disputed, one of Heydrich's orders. That's what the story is. And he was demoted, and he had to go and serve in the Waffen-SS on the Eastern Front, which he did, and in 1943, due to his health, he was sent to the West, where he served as an economic administrator for the troops in Belgium. So he was in Belgium, and Belgium was liberated, as they call it, in September and October of 1944. And in November, Nauyuk surrendered or deserted. Some people say deserted. Some people say surrendered. But the SS didn't surrender, and the German troops didn't surrender, so he surrendered on his own. So what he did was he on his own turned himself over to U.S. forces, who placed him in detention as a possible war criminal, they say. But, you know, he had this pretty high rank in the SS and the SD, so he certainly bartered what he had, information, for his freedom. That was his choice. That's what he decided to do. And he was in U.S. custody, and they kept him in until the end of the war, probably for his protection. If he had been out roaming around after doing that, the SS would have killed him or would have arrested him and executed him. So he remained with the U.S. until the war was over, and then he was just released. And they say, he escaped custody. Well, how could he escape custody when they knew who he was, when he had been there with them for 6 months or so in their custody? So he didn't escape custody. He was released because he made a deal with them. And therefore, when they needed his affidavit at the Nuremberg trials in 1946, he gave it to them. Now, what he said in this, and his testimony, his affidavit was signed the day before the Nuremberg trial started. That's when they got that from him. So that's telling too. But he said that the attack against the Gleiwitz radio tower, this is what he said in his affidavit. Oh, okay, I'm back. Most of them never appeared. Only like 33 witnesses actually appeared in person so they could be cross-examined by the defense. But he did not. It was just his affidavit. And then the defense lawyers just have to respond to what was said in the affidavit. So he said that the attack against the Gleiwitz radio tower was under orders. He was ordered to do that by Heydrich and Heinrich Mueller, chief of the Gestapo. So let's see if I've got. I think I'm in the wrong place. Okay, here's his testimony. He says on or about 10th August 1939, the chief of the SIPO and SD, Heydrich, personally ordered me to simulate an attack on the radio station near Gleiwitz, near the Polish border, and to make it appear that the attacking force consisted of Poles. Heydrich said to him, actual proof of these attacks of the Poles is needed for the foreign press as well as for German propaganda purposes. Well, here's something very strange, that this they would have decided this and set this up on August 10th already, 20 days before the actual time, because the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact hadn't even been signed. So, you know, they weren't planning a war at this time. They were trying to avoid this, and they thought that they would be able to do it because they were given false signals. The Germans were given false signals by the British and so on. So they continued with this pursuing negotiation right up until the last minute, which you can read about that elsewhere. But So he said that he was supposed to go to, he was directed to go to Gleiwitz with five or six SD men, but then he never mentions these SD men again, and he never gives any names. Who were these SD men? And once the war is over, he could have named them. Couldn't some of these men have come forth and said, you know, and corroborated his testimony? See, things like that give it away. This is true in all this Holocaust stuff, too. All these Holocaust survivors, they never have corroborating witnesses for the things that they say. So he was supposed to go to Gleiwitz with these five or six other men and wait there until he received a code word from Heydrich and that indicated that the attack should take place. So his instructions, he says, were to seize the radio station and to hold it long enough to permit a Polish-speaking German who would be put at his disposal to broadcast a speech in Polish. He said that Heydrich told him that this speech should state that the time had come for the conflict between the Germans and the Poles, and that the Poles should get together and strike down any Germans from whom they met resistance. Well, this is what these Poles who did go into the Gleiwitz, I guess, and say a few words over the radio there. That's what they said. They were kind of calling for the Poles to unite and strike down any Germans who they met. So he said that Heydrich told him that at this time, on August 10th, that he expected an attack on Poland by Germany in a few days. Well, once again, this is all hearsay. Everything here is hearsay because there's nobody to corroborate that anything that he's saying is the truth. So the other part of his affidavit says, I went to Gleiwitz and waited there a fortnight, 2 weeks, until August 24th. And then I requested permission from Heydrich to return to Berlin, but I was told to stay in Gleiwitz. And on the 25th, between then and the 31st, he went to see Heinrich Mueller, head of the Gestapo, who was at Opeln, which was nearby, you know, not No, I can't say. I thought that was in Poland, but anyway. In my presence, Mueller discussed with a man named Mellehorn, plans for another border incident, which should be made to appear that Polish soldiers were attacking German troops. Now, this man, Mellehorn, where is he? I guess he couldn't be found to come and corroborate Now Yox was saying. Okay, so then he says that that Mueller stated that he had 12 or 13 condemned criminals who were to be dressed in Polish uniforms and left dead on the ground at the scene of the incident. 10 or 12 who were to be left dead, but there was only one, see, when it actually happened. And to show that they had been killed while attacking, and that for this purpose they were to be given fatal injections by a doctor employed by Heydrich. This sounds very complicated, doesn't it? This fatal injection thing, too, is like these Jewish prosecutors at Nuremberg, they were working on this Holocaust stuff, too. And, of course, all the doctors in the camps and stuff were giving fatal injections to these poor prisoners. So this fatal injections was a big idea at the time that they had. So now they even have, in this instance, they came up with that they had doctors giving fatal injections to these concentration camp people who were dressed in Polish uniforms.
With all these people involved, do you think they could find more than Naujoks just to verify the story?
Well, that's right. And thanks for reiterating that point, because they have nobody here, nobody who will says this except him. And then they were given gunshot wounds. After they were given the fatal injection, Naujok said they were given gunshot wounds. Now, I looked it up to make sure, but the dead don't bleed. So if you give them a fatal injection, then you don't give them gunshot wounds after that, because after your heart stops beating, you don't keep bleeding. But then Naujok says in this affidavit, after the assault, members of the press and other persons were to be taken to the spot of the incident. Well, did that happen? No. A police report was subsequently to be prepared. Well, there was a police report. Then he says, Mueller told me that he had an order from Heydrich to make one of those criminals available to me for the action at Gliwice. The code name by which he referred to these criminals was Canned Goods. So obviously, these 12 or 13 ones who were given fatal injections were supposed to be put elsewhere, around the border or something, to make it because the Germans wanted it to look like, they were dressed in, they were dressed in Polish. This doesn't make, I don't know. The whole thing gets so confusing that it doesn't make much sense. But he had only one of them, and then he says that he participated in this on the evening preceding the German attack, and at noon on the 31st of August, I received by telephone from Heydrich the code word for the attack, which was to take place at 8 o'clock. And Heydrich said, everything is code, but they don't tell you what the code words were always. Heydrich said, in order to carry out this attack, report to Mueller for canned goods. I did this and gave Mueller instructions to deliver the man near the radio station. I received this man, this one man, and had him laid down at the entrance to the station. He was alive, but he was completely unconscious. I tried to open his eyes. I could not recognize by his eyes that he was alive, only by his breathing. I did not see the shot wounds, but a lot of blood was smeared across his face. He was in civilian clothes. Now, first they were supposed to be given fatal injections, but maybe it was a slow-acting fatal injection. I don't know. But this man was still alive when he left him there, and he didn't see any gunshot wounds in him, but he does say that he shot him. So he says, we seized the radio station as ordered. We broadcast a speech of 3 to 4 minutes, him and his six or seven other guys, over an emergency transmitter. We fired some pistol shots and left. That's his story, which was accepted, and nobody questioned it. All right, there is some questioning from the counsel for the SD, because this was a crime attributed to the SD, you know, under Heydrich before he died, and then Kaltenbrunner, to make them a criminal, to make them guilty of crimes against peace, so they could hang all of these guys. And so they had a council. They had their own council, and was given to him, I guess. And he says that the crime against peace the SD is accused of having staged, these so-called border incidents before the outbreak of the war, to give Hitler an excuse for starting the war. He says that they referred to only one border incident, and he says that the witness testified, that's Naljuk, that no sections from Department 3 and 6 were used. The witness further stated that he was charged with the execution of the border incident in Gliwice, not because he belonged to these departments in the SD, but that exclusively personal reasons were responsible for that decision. I didn't read that part, but he says that Heydrich told him that, he got the distinct impression that Heydrich would have chose him not because of his position in the SS and SD, but for other reasons, personal reasons. Never, doesn't say what they are. And he says that that the SD departments that had to do with this whole affair had no knowledge that the attack was carried out by Naljuks and a member of and some other members, because it was all done like off the record, off the books. So he is saying, I think, that they couldn't find the SD responsible or guilty of this because they didn't do it as an official organization. But that's the best that he could do. But there are a lot of questions about this. Well, we've still got 10 minutes left to talk about them. So I have some good comments myself about why this thing doesn't make any sense.
Well, but, I have like something I found here.
Okay.
About Naljuks. I was looking, I looked at the Wikipedia article on Naljuks about three years ago, and it was interesting that they couldn't make up their mind when he died. And
they've got it down that he died in 1966.
Yes, look.
He was a businessman. He became a businessman of some kind in Hamburg. He didn't have any problem after the war, and eventually he sold his story to a newspaper, his story was titled "The Man Who Started World War II."
Right.
Real flashy, showy kind of sensationalist stuff.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Now it says that he died in 1966, but 3 years ago it wasn't so clear. And somebody has pointed that out. I think I may have pointed it out myself. But if you go to German Wikipedia, it says Naljuks starb. It says Naljuks died on the 4th day of April 1966 in Hamburg. The year of death, 1960, named in the older literature, is wrong. So the older books say that he died in 1960, but now we're supposed to believe that he died in 1966.
Well, where are those? Where is that newspaper article? You can't find any of this stuff. And then the question has been asked: where are the pictures of the dead man, the man that was left there at the? If they were making such a big publicity out of this, if the Germans had set this up to be the whole pretext for attacking Poland, they would have had all kinds of publicity. Where are these newspapers and newsreels, which Alex Jones says were plastered all over the place by the Germans?
I was looking at the Democratic Underground, their little piece on Operation Canned Goods, and they quote some German newspaper headlines, and not one of them alludes whatsoever to an attack on a radio station.
Polish. Never happened. This is how they lie, and people just accept it and believe it because they have some faith in the person who's saying it, or where they're, because they see it written down in real words on some website. They don't ask for proof. People don't ask for evidence and proof. They just accept it because the whole idea of false flags is so believable. Well, of course, all governments use these false flags to do the things they want to do, but it just turns out that the very government that's most accused of false flagging, National Socialist Germany, didn't use false flags. I don't know of a single false flag that they used to start something. Do you?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that Germans can get away with that as easily, because the Germans are very critical of each other, and
okay.
They'll tell on each other.
Yeah, all right. Because the Reichstag fire is another one, and I don't want to talk about that at all tonight. But that's another one that's used just indiscriminately all over the place, with no and people are not sufficiently critical about it. Now, Gunther Kummel, who is a German and who writes about some of these things, he has written that neither Hitler nor any other official made use of the Gliwice incident to vindicate the attack on Poland. And he certainly has looked into that. So they never used it. And the fact is that's just extra stuff that. But anyway, if such a thing actually happened, as I already said, Hitler would have used it. He would have mentioned it in that speech on September 1st. It would have been used by Goebbels in all kinds of, all the way through the war. You know, I mean, it would have been, but it wasn't. So it wasn't something that the Germans did. It was a real attack by the Poles. It wasn't a real big deal. Somebody was killed. It may have been a real Pole. It probably was a real Polish irregular who was killed, and his body was found there by the German. I think that was some Waffen SS troops that came in and chased those Poles away.
Right.
And in the other place, it was the German police, the German border police, who chased the ones away who were in that customs house.
Right, and more importantly, it was only one of 21 such incidents that occurred on a single night, and it was the culmination of many months of provocations, you know, and troubles with attacks on German ethnic Germans living in Poland and things like this. It was a minor detail.
Yeah, and that's why I was very glad to find that article on German views that where this fellow is looking into this himself and saying that at Nuremberg, Jackson, they had to find something to use, and this wasn't the only thing they used, but they had to find things to use to prove that Germany was the aggressor, or otherwise they would have, in a fair trial, they would have been shown themselves to be aggressors. And so this is a part of it. Now, this is why this has been played up. And Ira, what do you think of when I say that Alex Jones and Mike Rivero and others, Stephen Lendman and any number of others, keep talking about this? These people are supposed to be researchers. This is so easy to look at and find out, but they don't do it. Why don't they do it? Because they're looking out for Jewish interests. That's exactly what they're doing.
Well, it doesn't even have to be that. There's a kind of cheap shysterism that pervades U.S. political rhetoric. People constantly have their finger in the wind looking for what kind of angle they can use to make their cheap argument. You know, what is the prejudice of my audience? And I'm going to cater to whatever prejudice is already there. Not try to straighten out their thinking. Just tell them whatever will get them to do what I want them to do right now.
Well,
so
that's
we end up.
What Mike Rivero said. That's actually what he said when he told that caller. And so you think that's exactly what he may be saying. Exactly what he means. That's why they do it. That's almost worse because it is so cheap, such cheap shysterism.
And then we end up having to fight with these people who should be on our same side because they're so deeply committed to this Jewish mythology.
That's right. Yeah, they can't. And that's where I think the Jewish part comes in. They're loyal. I mean, you know, they're loyal. They have it's not something that they maybe have decided in a real conscious way, but they just can't overcome their loyalty to their own people. And to Jews, the Holocaust is something that they just cannot go against, and so they have to blame Hitler for everything that happened. They have to blame Hitler for starting the war, and that led to that, all of that. And they're not able to stop doing it. And this is a real hurdle to overcome. Oh, I want to say before we go off the air, which we've only got a minute or so, that what I would like from this program, because as I said, I'm not going to change this story that's all over the place and get the truth out by what I've said here tonight and you, that I'd like every listener to write or call these people whenever it comes up and tell them that you're on to them, that you wish they would quit putting out false and fake stories that make them look insincere, that they would start telling the truth. You know, I really think they have to hear this, but they don't hear it because, as you pointed out, unfortunately, too many of the people like hearing it. They want to hear it, and so they keep maybe that's why Alex Jones keeps saying it, but I don't think that's the only reason. So I think these people have to hear from the rest of us and hear from us a lot to make them, just like that caller called in to Mike Rivera and in an angry voice said, you know, why do you keep doing this Hitler bashing stuff? Why do you keep doing this?
And Alex Jones doesn't care about the truth. You know, I called him in the mid-1990s and told him it wasn't true that Hitler took away everybody's guns, and it didn't stop him from continuing to say it.
Okay, well, thank you, Hattie, and thank you, listeners. This has been the most unusual program with all the discussions. Thank you for being with us, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.